These are the stories that you need to know about today. A shocking turn of events in Europe. Germany is reaching out to Russia, wanting to bring it back into the European Community of Nations. France, Italy, maybe Finland are all saying kind of the same thing. Following suit, they too want to make peace with Putin, who also has responded. And Canada is also switching sides. Apparently fed up with the latest tariff wars with Washington, it's reaching out to China in a big way. Wow, all this on the Sanchez Effect. Let's do it. Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez, and welcome to The Effect, where we begin with Europe flipping on Russia. That's right. They're saying it's time that Russia, as, quote, the largest country in Europe, is welcomed back into the European Community of Nations. Now, if you're thinking, what? So was I when I first saw this. But let me tell you who's saying this. Let me tell you who's saying he wants Russia to be back into the European Community of Nations. It's German Chancellor Friedrich Merz. And let me tell you something about this guy. This is the same guy who not long ago was pushing Ukraine to shoot long-range missiles into Russia. And even more recently, same guy who was proposing to rebuild Germany's army so that it can prepare for war with Russia. Now, he's saying this.
If we can then still manage to ensure that peace and freedom return to Europe, then we finally find a balance once again with our largest European neighbor, namely Russia. Russia is a European country. If we manage in the longer term to reestablish a balance with Russia, when peace prevails, when freedom is guaranteed, if we succeed in all of this, ladies and gentlemen, then this European Union and we in Germany will have passed another crucial test, and then we can look forward with great confidence beyond 2026.
It's amazing. I mean, yeah, that's what he said. You heard him right. Germany's chancellor wants to team up with, quote, our largest European neighbor. And what's interesting is that Germany has for years been complicit with the European Union and NATO in isolating Russia. No contact, no communications, no negotiations. So what's with this sudden change, right? I'm going to get to that. But first, let me tell you who else is on board with this. France. That's right, France. France is signaling it's time to reunite with President Putin. President Emmanuel Macron has been signaling for weeks now, last week, the week before, that it's time to re-engage with Russia. Here he is when this kind of began, his first signals in late December, when he was asked about whether he would meet with Putin.
I think it will be useful to talk to Vladimir Putin again. Yes, in any case, I see that there are people who talk to Vladimir Putin.
Who else is on board? Italy! The prime minister there, Giorgia Meloni, says, begrudgingly, kind of holding her nose, yes, it's time to go talk to Putin.
On cooperation, I think that Macron is right on this. I believe the time has come for Europe to also speak with Russia.
But, you know, maybe the strongest and most well-thought-out argument for re-engaging with Russia, because all of these guys are saying, yeah, we want to do it, but you know deep down they kind of don't want to. They're kind of prejudiced about Russia. So the one guy who seems earnest about this is somebody who comes from the other side of the Gulf of Finland. Here's a headline. Let me show it to you. There it is. That's and they're talking about Finland's former president, Sauli Niinisto, who served from 2012 to 2024, and he's saying essentially that Europe needs Russia. According to him, Europe must engage President Putin because Europe's global influence is diminishing. He argues that Europe must reach out to Russia to avoid being divided by external powers, namely the United States and China. There you go. Look, when you think about it, his argument makes sense, right? But it's not new. This is an argument that President Putin himself has been arguing for going back to 2001. That's when he, Putin, asked, I think it was President Bush under his term, he argued that Russia should be allowed to join NATO. He said, bring me in. I want to be a part of your team. And now Putin is responding as well, by the way, to this latest invitation. Here's what he's saying.
Russia was and remains committed to precisely these approaches and is ready to restore the level of relations we require. Our relations have deep historical roots, full of examples of mutually beneficial partnership and mutually enriching cultural cooperation.
So why then is this change occurring now, right? Why is this happening? Why the sudden olive branch, right? Why suddenly are European leaders reaching out to President Putin, to Russia, right? I mean, I know there's still things to be worked out, but still, their tone seems totally different, right? Well, the answer is contained in a series of recent events that would give most people whiplash the way they've happened. What it's given Europe, though, is a heavy dose of reality. I want to take you through it. Here we go. First and foremost, and this is the underpinning of everything, Russia is winning the war. And deep down, Europe knows that. They just don't want to admit it. Slowly but consistently, Russia is decimating the Ukrainian army. Number two, Trump, not Europe, recognized that early, and he chose to pick sides by negotiating directly with Putin, right? Think about it. And where does that leave Europe? Out in the cold. They're not in the boardroom. They're left to watch these negotiations, these talks, while two world superpower leaders are discussing it, and Europe is on the sidelines. Ouch. Number three, Europe becomes angry about that. So it escalates the anti-Russia rhetoric. It announces plans to steal Russia's frozen assets, more than $230 billion. They plan to gift that money, Russia's money, to Ukraine. It's crazy. Putin fires back with some chilling statements like this one.
Theft is an inappropriate description. Theft is a covert seizing of property, but in our case, they are trying to do it openly. That's called robbery. And so why can't this robbery be carried out? Well, because the consequences could be dire for the robbers themselves.
So what happens next? That gets us to number four. Russia is then hit, like during the holidays, with two drone attacks. One that it says was aimed at the residence of President Putin, and another that leaves 500,000, half a million Russians in the dark during the holidays. Without water, without electricity. This time, Putin gets real angry. He doesn't talk, he signals. Russia shows Europe. It doesn't tell Europe. It shows Europe what it's capable of doing to them.
Russian military sources also confirmed they'd launched what they called a massive strike with a powerful hypersonic missile called Oryeshnik against critical facilities.
The pictures that are emerging of the damage caused are quite extraordinary. Russia overnight has fired more than 200 drones and dozens of missiles, including an intermediate range supersonic ballistic missile designed to cause maximum damage, and it has.
Yeah, they shut down the Ukrainian energy grid, and then finally, the U.S. sends its own signals. Wow. This is it, like this. It kidnaps the president of Venezuela. Amazing, huh? And then it says, oh, and now we're going to take over Greenland. Oh, and now we're going to take over Greenland. A European territory that is part of Europe, right? Part of NATO, part of the European Union. So what are we seeing? The squeeze is on. Squeeze is on. Think about it. Europe is being abandoned and threatened by the U.S. NATO and the EU are in a free fall, fractured and broke. Russia, stronger than ever, winning. It's not one thing. It's not one thing. It's a series of things that for Europe signals checkmate. And that is why they're reaching out to Russia. I feel like I'm in a commercial, but wait, there's more. There's another country that's now looking east. Guess who? Surprise, surprise. A prominent member of NATO is also looking eastward and accepting the new world order, where countries like Russia, India, and China are no longer to be treated like inferior countries, because they're not. This is Canada's Prime Minister, Mark Carney, in China over the weekend. He's laying down the gauntlet. He's signaling to the rest of his peers in NATO that it's time to go to the other side. It's time to accept the global south. It's time to accept the BRICS countries, if you will. That's what he's really saying. Carney's stepping out of Washington's shadow, doing so in a way that will leave a mark, a big mark. Here he is meeting and dealing with the Chinese President Xi.
The sound and stable development of China-Canada relations serves the common interests of our two countries and contributes to global peace, stability, and development.
I believe the progress that we have made in the partnership sets us up well for the new world order.
This is amazing, isn't it? I mean, this is all happening before our very eyes. It's a shift, right? Paradigm shift. This meeting with between China and Canada was obviously ceremonial, but also extremely substantive. Because following the ceremony, both leaders sat down, had long conversations with their teams, of course, and then they made statements that were aimed right at Washington and right at Europe, but specifically at Trump's tariff war on both China and Canada. Prime Minister Carney even went as far as doing what many were calling unthinkable, maybe even ballsy. He's going to allow China to export its electric vehicles, China, electric vehicles, not just regular vehicles, into Canada.
Canada has agreed to allow up to 49,000 Chinese electric vehicles into the Canadian market, with the most favored nation tariff rate of 6.1%. This is a return to the levels that existed prior to recent trade frictions.
Most favored nation status. Take that. Wow. I mean, this big. This statement is a direct message to the United States, which has, by the way, kind of a long-standing unofficial prohibition, or maybe even call it a ban, if you will, although that's not the official term. On not just EVs, right? Not just electric vehicles, but all Chinese vehicles, or Russian vehicles to boot. Wow. To discuss these incredible, titanic global shifts that are taking place, I'm joined now by Arthur Estopinian. He's an international and public affairs chief with 27 years experience in the United States Congress, former chief of staff and official spokesperson for the chairman emeritus of the House of Foreign Affairs Committee. Wow, Arturo, I don't know where to begin other than to say,
hey, Rick.
Hello, my friend. Good to see you again.
Likewise, great to see you. Thank you so much.
What do you make of this? I mean, I just took our viewers through a litany of all the changes that are taking place in our world. And, you know, I think there's a movie out there, cool young guys like you probably know the title better than I do, Fast and Furious. It seems like everything is happening fast and furious.
Absolutely, Rick. And, you know, this is called leadership. Your question and your presentation was very impressive because that is the reality, that things are moving very fast. The European Union accepting Russia into the European Union and all, it's going to be extraordinary. But I think that leadership is not, it doesn't happen by mistake. It doesn't happen by an error. It happens because of President Trump's leadership. Mm-hmm. Take us back just almost a year ago under President Biden's leadership, and we saw war, we saw devastation, we saw economic collapse, and now everything has changed. And Russia is definitely a significant country in that new world order, in the geopolitical reformation of the world that President Trump and his team with Secretary Rubio have unleashed.
When it comes to the Ukraine situation, you're giving Trump props for understanding what was reality, right? And not only did he recognize it, but he acted on it. He said, this is ridiculous that we have this small country, Ukraine, who's fighting a superpower who really could wipe them out if they really wanted to, but hasn't wanted to. But even that's kind of a lie, because it's not really a war between Ukraine and Russia. It's a war between the West, Biden's Washington, and all of Europe, and Russia. So what Trump was doing essentially was looking at this, holding a mirror up to it and saying, this is the reality. And it seemed like the Europeans didn't want to buy that at first, but he's kind of forced them into a quandary. It's interesting. Well, I'll let you comment on that, and then I'm going to go with the follow-up, but go ahead.
No, I mean, what he has said it, Rick, you know, publicly, I want the war to stop. Yeah. I want the Russian soldiers to stop dying. I want the Ukrainian soldiers to stop dying. And he's a businessman. Remember, he's not a traditional politician that just blah, 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 blah. He's a man of action. Let's meet with Putin. Let's try to get a deal, stop the war. And this is the steps that, you know, his administration has been working towards.
This is what puts, you know, in my conversation with my viewers, and now at the beginning of my conversation with you, we're talking about this pickle that Europe finds itself in. I mean, you're an investor. I'm sure you've got a couple of dollars on Wall Street. So do I. I know very well what a short squeeze is. And this is a short squeeze for Europe. I mean, their benefactor is telling them, we can't afford to support you anymore. And the company, or in this case, the country that they bet against is doing better than ever. What the hell are they going to do?
Yeah. Not only that, but President Trump is an entrepreneur. He wants to build. He understands the contribution that Russia can contribute towards this new world order. And he's going... he's pursuing that.
The problem with President Trump, though, is although I agree with you, I think his instincts are good. And I think the things he has said and the things he generally tries to do and has done in the case of Ukraine, as we both agree, by dealing with the reality of the situation and not what we want it to be, has been effective. The problem is there are people over President Trump, people, as you well know, who are part of the military establishment, people who make money on wars, people who are very tied to the nation of Israel, who get in his ear and sometimes in his pocketbook, and as a result, the decisions don't come out the right way oftentimes. What do you say about that?
Well, perhaps initially, and maybe that happened in the first administration, but now we've seen the type of restraint that he's using lately in Iran. And he warned the mullahs and the ayatollah, stop the killing of the civilians or the United States will respond militarily. And then he heard from the Gulf country leaders and he stepped back. So I think his first instinct, in my opinion, is not military option, which the United States, as we saw in Iran and we saw in Venezuela, you know, is a tremendous power. So that's not his main first instinct. His first instinct is let's talk. Like he talked with Mr. Putin in Alaska, and he's talked to Kim Jong-un in North Korea, and he's going to China in April. So his first instinct is to talk. Let's talk. And yes, he has advisors, before, like Ambassador Bolton in the previous administration. Less so in this administration, I believe. He understands what politics is all about, and he steps back and says, well, let me talk to that leader, and let me see how we could compromise. Let's see what we could do. So you're right. I mean, he has advisors that want to bomb. We have senators that want to bomb everything. But he says, okay, let's step back and let's talk first.
But the problem is Iran, for example, is a canard. The whole world has recognized the fact that this so-called mistreatment of protesters in Iran, while there may have been some of that, much of it was created by the Mossad. Much of it was the Mossad has admitted to it. I mean, Israel has come out and said, yeah, well, our agents are there. They're on the side of the protesters, and they're instigating much of the killing that is taking place. I mean, so...
But with the young people... Yeah, we have to recognize that the young people in Iran, the women, they want to take the burqa off. They want to take... You know, they want to live in 2025.
So do people in the United States. Yeah. So do people in the United States. We got people all over the country holding, rioting and holding protests and fighting with ICE because they want to go around and pick up the guy who... You know, helps me in my house and helps my wife take care of the kids.
Many of the gardeners here are hiding because because they're afraid.
I know.
And domestic women that take care of, you know, they clean homes, they take care of our children.
They're good people.
Yeah, that's good, hardworking people. And that's an issue that is very serious. But President Biden opened the border, and we had millions and millions of illegals. Some of them are terrorists, and some of them
but
are
so
criminals.
But so did Trump.
And we cannot accept that.
So did Trump, and so did Obama, and so did Biden, and so did Reagan, and so did Bush. They all did. These people didn't come all under Biden. That's a canard. They came over every single president in that country.
25 million came under Biden. Open borders does not work, and President Trump closed the borders. So the Iranian people, in my opinion, the young people, they're tired of this nonsense. They want to live in a free and democratic society, and they're rebelling against the government there.
And you're right. And I think there's a reason for that as well, though. Oftentimes, I'd like to think that these things just happen naturally, but they don't. You know very well, Aturing, that we intervene and we interfere. The West has been doing this for years. Part of this conversation that you and I are having is fascinating, because part of the conversation that people don't get in the United States is, yeah, we've got a lot of immigrants in the United States, people like you, people like me. Now, I am so proud to be an American and so thankful for everything that the United States has allowed me to be able to gain from an educational standpoint. But I know damn well that the only reason my parents came to this country was because the United States, in many ways, messed with the institutions of other countries. Hondurans don't want to be in America. Hondurans want to be in Honduras. Guatemalans don't want to be in America. They want to be in Guatemala. You could go to any of these countries and see where we intervene and did things that created a ruinous condition for the people, making them want to leave those countries and then come to America. And now we're mad that they're here, you know, helping us with our children.
Well, the fact of the matter is that especially the Central American immigrants that I'm more familiar with are hardworking people. You know, I have some construction projects and remodeling. They come in at 7 a.m. and leave at 5, 6, or 7 sometimes. So we need those kind of workers, but we need to know who they are. We cannot have an open border policy. I'm sure Russia doesn't have an open border policy.
Of course not. No country
does. We need to know who they are. And the issue right now is a humane way.
Yes.
And the answer is immigration reform by the U.S. Congress. That is what is needed. That leadership is missing.
Yeah, but I mean, it's almost like the toothpaste is already out, right? So you're trying to, I see these ICE agents, so I'm sure they're just trying to do their jobs, but someone's telling them, go find all the toothpaste capsules and try and stick the toothpaste back in. Man, you can't do that. Not in the U.S. based on the Constitution. You can't go up to a person and says, prove to me you're legal. Prove to me you're not a criminal. You can't do that.
And the American people in recent pollings do support legal immigration. So perhaps a middle ground of temporary working permits is the way to go. You know, let's get them up, and if they learn English, they study American history, you know, show us that you want to be part of the United States, then maybe extend that working permit to a residency and so on and so forth. But there has to be an expulsion of all of the Islamic extremists, terrorists that are here in this country, and the violent criminals. That has to stop.
I'm wondering, given your adherence to the Trump policies, some of which I agree with and some of which I don't, I wonder what you think of what Trump has done with Europe. He basically is the first president in my lifetime to essentially signal to Europe, you're just not that important anymore. You're kind of small in the scheme of things, and I'm going to turn my direction elsewhere. By the way, if you guys want our support, pay for it. Otherwise, go to hell. That seems to be what he's telling them, and they're now kind of receiving that message. Have I characterized it correctly?
Well, Rick, you know, I don't want my European friends to be angry at me. But the fact of the matter is that we live, like you said, in the new world order. We live in a fast-paced, you know, internet, AI environment. Europe needs to get, you know, history and tradition is fine and dandy, but Europe needs to catch up. If not, we see Asia. So when you go to Europe and when you go to Asia, it's totally different dynamics. You know, for example, in China, you have high-speed internet, you have fast trains, you have everything is digitalized, the money's. I mean, and when you go to Europe, they're still living back in the 1980s or 90s. That has to change. And that is what Trump is telling them. Guys, he's telling them to their face, Europe, you know, get with the times. You have to, you know, you have to modernize. You have to become more competitive in today's global world. And I think that that's what he's telling them. And he's told them in no uncertain terms. And I think that he's working hard on that. And I think that that's going to help the overall world peace and economy. That's how I see it. That's how he sees it. He sees it through the lens of a businessman, not as a politician.
You know, and you also just look at, you look at, do a comparison. We could just do a comparison in our head, right? The European Union is fractured, right? There's countries in the European Union who says, we don't even want to be a part of this anymore. You've got countries like Turkey who are attending BRICS summits and other meetings of other countries around the world, kind of showing like, you know, we maybe want to flip over to the other side. We haven't yet done it, but we're certainly putting our toes in the water, so to speak. So that's happening. But even more importantly, when you look at Europe, Arthur, what have they got? I mean, Russia is the country with the most oil, the most hydrocarbons, probably the most resources in the world, the most land in the world. China is the country with the most people in the world, with the strongest, arguably one of the strongest economies in the world, if not very soon the strongest economy in the world. India has an extremely vibrant social services. I mean, I could go down the list and talk about these attributes from these countries, and then you compare them to these countries in Europe. They have no oil. They have no resources. They're basically just places where banking takes place. I mean, even if they wanted to, what the hell can they do to get out of their own way?
Well, Europe is, in my opinion, Europe is a rich historical area of beautiful churches and museums and
castles.
And they have what's that?
And castles.
Yeah. Castles, lots of castles. I mean, so the reality is that they have all of those richness, right? Historical richness. But the young people need more than that, Rick, in order for them to be competitive in today's world. And unless they do that, they're going to continue to fall further and further behind.
All right, let's talk about Latin America. I don't think what the United States is doing in Venezuela is in the end going to be good at all for the world. I think the message that is being sent that might makes right is not a healthy message. And obviously, no matter how you look at it, even if I don't think he is, by the way, but if Maduro were the biggest drug dealer in the history of the world, one country does not have a right to go into another country and act as it's that country's police force. You just can't. You got to find another way to do it, if you will. So my argument is it's wrong. Now, the message it seems to be sending, at least to Europe and other countries, might be effective in the short run. How do you see it?
Well, Rick, the fact of the matter is that dictator Maduro was not elected by the people, by the Venezuelan people.
None of our business. None of our business. What are we? Who the hell are we to go around the world deciding what president was? You can argue there. We haven't had a president in the United States elected democratically in 40 years. When you consider how the donors really choose the two people we get to vote for, do you really think Hillary Clinton was the choice of the American people for the Democratic Party? It wasn't. It was Bernie Sanders.
Maria Corina Machado, who's part of the opposition leader, you know, proved to the world via the ballot, the physical ballots, that they had 80% of the vote, popular vote.
I'll give you that, but that doesn't give a country the right. Okay, So let's argue the United States. Trump recently...
Let me make my argument.
Trump recently argued that his election was stolen from him. Did that give Russia or China the right to go into the United States and remove Joe Biden and put in Donald Trump? Why not?
Look, Rick, the fact of the matter is that the United States, as the leader in the Western Hemisphere, as Latin America, he cannot allow for a dictator, you know, who loses an election to say, I'm not leaving. Guys, I have the military and I have the money and I have the power and I'm not saying, no, that's not going to be tenable. President Biden, because he was so weak and the Democrats allowed that to happen. But President Trump is not. And his main architect, Secretary Rubio, whom you know very well, is coordinating the cleanup of Latin America, in my opinion, from Hezbollah, from Hamas, all of the Islamic terrorists that are affiliated with the African jihadists. That all is going to be changing. And the Venezuelan people are so happy because they're going to go back to Venezuela rebuild that country that is a very rich country.
We may disagree on that because I think in many ways the problems with Venezuela were in many ways caused by our actions in Venezuela. But I want to get back to my point where you and I both, you know, I respect the hell out of you. I think you're a really smart guy, and you and I have talked many times in the past. I'm wondering, at what point do we have to say it's not cool for one country to go in and remove the president of another country, no matter what the conditions are? There has to be a better way to do that, or every country will start doing this all over the world. And then we're going to have problems when it comes knocking on our door. That's my point.
As you know, Rick, Mr. Maduro, as the head of the Cartel de los Soles, it was designated by the United States as a foreign terrorist organization. So this was not a military exercise. It was an extraction from an indictment of a United States federal court in southern New York that indicted him because of the evidence that they had that he was sending drugs, illegal narcotics, to the United States.
Yeah.
The United States has a big problem, as you know, Ray. 100,000 young people or so die every year because of fentanyl and other drugs in the United States. That cannot continue.
So let
President
me. So
Trump
I, so,
has
so,
the
so I. So I checked
to be
on
able
that.
To stop so, that, and so, he has stopped
so,
that.
So I checked on that. What you just said, because of course I saw that same report. So immediately I went to Mr. Google's and Mr. ChatGPT and AI, and I looked up every piece of research I could. 98% of the fentanyl that comes to the United States comes from Mexico, not
Mexico.
Venezuela.
Yep. 98%
comes from Mexico. And much of it is helped by gun manufacturers who furnish the weapons for those cartels in Mexico. So why are we not attacking Mexico? Maybe we should remove the president of Mexico tomorrow, then, if that's the real reason why we're doing this. You see what I mean?
President Sheinbaum. No, but listen, that's a good point. So President Sheinbaum is cooperating with the United States. She's not dancing like Mr. Maduro was dancing and telling President Trump, you're not men enough to come and get me, come and get me. I mean, he provoked him. But that's not why President Trump did it. I mean, President Sheinbaum of Mexico has turned in, extradited to the United States, 56 convicted narco traffickers from Mexico, and now they're being tried here in the United States with evidence that the United States has. So this is all based on a very deliberate and structured cleanup, as I mentioned before, of the Western Hemisphere. And under President Trump's leadership, that is going to change. And the Venezuelan people are going to be able to go back and rebuild their country. They have gas, they have petroleum, they have uranium. Yeah. And it's one of the richest countries in the world. And unfortunately, under Mr. Maduro's and Chavez's leadership, it was a total failure.
I think you just gave up the ghost, though, my friend. If you and What's I were that? To argue, well, if you and I, and I enjoying this conversation, I feel like we're at a bar in Miami having a couple of beers and sharing ideas. Cuba Libres, right. If the real argument is, what was the true intention for the United States doing this? Let me give you something which is also a fact, which makes this very interesting, if nothing else, coincidental, if not paradoxical. And that is this. Of the three countries in the world with the richest deposits or reserves of oil, one is Venezuela and the other is Iran. And those are the two countries that the United States is either threatening with takeover or interfering or whatever you want to say.
But doesn't that kind of
give up the ghost? I mean, doesn't that tell reveal the real reason why this is happening?
But Trump is not shy about that. He has said, I will use Venezuela's, he says, I will use Venezuela's oil to have a geopolitical negotiations with Mr. Putin in Russia and with China. So, I mean, he's not afraid of saying that. And we will use the benefits of the sales of the oil to help the Venezuelan people. And we will sell, the United States will sell that oil in international markets. So, I mean, this is a whole new geopolitical.
Yes, it is, but it's not their oil. It's not their oil. I mean, this is crazy. Oil, which really belongs to us, which we're now going to go back and take, but somehow it ended up under your country. Who knows why? We're going to go back now, and we're going to do deals and sell it all over the world so our people, our business people can make money. That just sounds crazy to me.
No, because we will turn half of it to the Venezuelan people so that they could have medicine, food, and housing are the main priorities. As Secretary Rubio has said, stability is the first phase. Then it's reconstruction, and then a transition to democracy. So the fact of the matter is that we're not taking that. The United States is not taking those funds for ourselves. They're compensated American companies that were confiscated by Chavez when he was the president, democratically elected, mind you, first. So, I mean, it's a whole transitional period, but that's what President Trump is doing. We saw it in Panama when Secretary Rubio was confirmed. He sent Secretary Rubio to talk to the president. Eventually, the canal is back in the United States' hands. Mm. And that focus of the Western Hemisphere, Rick, is going to continue, in my opinion, during President Trump's administration.
I'll tell you what, and maybe this is where you and I come to a kind of a meeting point on this, because obviously we look at these things a little differently. I tend to be a little more of an internationalist from the standpoint of war and peace, and I worry about something like any country just going in and saying might makes right in a situation like this. But you're right. To a certain extent, Trump is not doing anything that hasn't been done before. You could go back to 1953 and look at Arbenz in Guatemala. You could go back to 54 and Mossadegh in Iran. You could look at all these places where the West and the United States, CIA eventually, whatever, MI6, have gone in and said, but we're doing it for democracy. We're doing it for the people. You're right. Trump just says, no, we're not going to talk about democracy and this and some little girl who was hurt or this or that. No, he just comes out and says it. They've got a lot of oil. We know what to do with it. We're going to take it. And to a certain extent, same as Greenland. Greenland is perfect for the United States. It has rare earth minerals that equate to some of the most important rare earth minerals in the world, especially when it comes to defense, technology. So we're interested in Greenland.
It's in the U.S. national security's interest for us to be able to administer Greenland.
It's no different from anything that past presidents and past administrations did. He's just calling it what it is, right?
Exactly.
My
question, Rick, is knowing the United States military power, why didn't Mr. Maduro pack his bags and become neighbors with Al-Saud or now maybe Mr. Diaz-Canel from Cuba or the Ortegas from Nicaragua? I mean, that is what's coming. And that is part of the cleanup of Latin America, in my opinion, under this administration.
Be careful. Be careful what you wish for. I mean, my fear
is... They have new neighbors in Moscow.
No. I mean, my fear is for my country as an American. I mean, you and I, you're old enough. I mean, you and I lived through Vietnam. Iraq is a disaster. We went in there with, I heard people saying the same things to you on CNN conversations when I was on Fox and CNN. People told me the same thing. Oh, no, this is going to be great. It's going to work. We're going to get the oil. We're going to do this. Iraq was a disaster. Afghanistan was a disaster. Syria and Libya, arguable, but in many ways, they've been a disaster. We go into these places with all these ideals, and sometimes we end up stepping on our own feet.
It's different. Do you see military, U.S. military in Venezuela at this time? No. It's not. You're absolutely right. The disaster that the United States led in Iraq and Afghanistan under the model of democracy was 100% failure. That is not the new dynamics. That is not the new paradigm that the United States is pursuing under President Trump. So it's going to be interesting. If it's successful, I think it's going to be the new approach for the United States to try to help in establishing of a democratic process in these countries in our Western Hemisphere.
Well, I'll tell you what, it sure is great to have this conversation with you. I'm glad you look great.
Sir.
Family's good.
Yes, they are. Thank you. You, congratulations. I mean, I remember seeing you when I was a young kid, and here I am in South Florida, and here I am seeing you all the way in Moscow, in Russia. So, you know, I'm so happy for you, and you know, it's a testament to your great reporting investigation. So, congratulations, and I'm sure that you know you're going to continue to grow. You know, but I understand that you're doing very well. So. Congratulations to you.
Well, and you know what's interesting? I'm glad you said that, because in many ways, this conversation that you and I just had, which to me, I hope you felt the same way, respectful, free, no rules. I wasn't reading questions to you. I was reacting to what you were saying. You were reacting to what I was saying. I don't see this on Fox and CNN and MSNBC and those places in America. It feels, and I know I work there, it feels constricted. We need more of these conversations with guys 100%. Like you and I sharing opinions, agreeing, disagreeing, or whatever.
And Rick, you know, the funny thing is I get criticized from my colleagues for coming here. And I tell them, look, as long as I am engaged in a free-flowing conversation, I will speak wherever I could speak, you know, wherever I'm invited. But you're absolutely 100% right. I think these kind of conversations on TV, in forums, I mean, the time has come for engagement, and I think this venue is very useful.
Thank you. Thank you. I'll tell it to my colleagues around here. It's great. We try. We really do. I've said this before. I'll say it again. I find myself with fewer handcuffs, more free, more in control of my own narration here than I did working at many of the stations in the United States. And to me, it's huge, you know? Nobody's telling you what to write or say.
Invite me to Moscow, and we'll have it in person.
You got it. It's a beautiful country and great people. All right, Arthur, take care, my friend. God bless you, and we'll see you soon.
Thank you, sir. Likewise. All the best.
Well, as you might imagine, when we do conversations like this, and that was really an interesting conversation. Obviously, we didn't agree on a lot of things, but it's important to share our ideas, right? We got tens of thousands of comments and more than 300,000 views at last count when I did my interview last week with Mohammed Mirandi at the height of the Iran conversation. He had a different opinion than Arthur's. Here's a sampling. Bill says, Professor Mohammed Mirandi, please continue enlightening people. Please continue opening their eyes and their minds. And Rick, thank you very much for hosting Professor Mirandi. Thank you, Bill. Then Arya Mamanam says, did I get that right? Arya Manam says to me, Rick Sanchez, you are fake news. Well, thank you. I appreciate that as well. Elegant Brain says, Iran is not our enemy. Respect for Professor Mirandi. Mirandi, thank you, Rick Sanchez. And then, oh dear, 2023 goes after Mirandi, probably went after me too, saying, Mirandi, did you get a one-way ticket to Russia already? Okay, as usual, all the feedback is appreciated. It really is. It doesn't matter when you want to be critical or disagree or agree. We're cool with that. On YouTube, you can check me out at Journalistically Speaking. Don't hesitate to speak your mind. Also, look for me on X, I go by Rick Sanchez TV, or Rick Sanchez TV. Hey, you know what? Thanks so much for letting us into your homes. Certainly appreciate it. And we'll be looking for you again mañana, tomorrow.